Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. I'm sure we all feel that we could use a little encouragement and practical advice when it comes to telling people about Jesus. Well, Ordinary is on hand to deliver just that. This is the first of a two-part conversation with evangelist Glenn Scrivener. Graham and Mark talk with Glenn about the current spiritual climate here in the UK and how the church can work in this climate to introduce people to the gospel in a meaningful way.
Hello, my name's Graham Nichols.
Hi, I'm Mark Ventham.
And this is the Ordinary Podcast. We are very excited today. Why are we excited today, Mark?
Because we have a very special guest with us today.
And what is this very special guest's name?
It's Glenn.
Welcome, Glenn, to Ordinary. Why don't you introduce yourself and say something about where you live and where you're from, anything else you want to tell us?
Terrific. Yes, I'm Glenn, and I'm very honoured to be a special guest on the Ordinary Podcast, a very ordinary guest. And I live in Eastbourne on the south coast of England, which is known as the Sunshine Coast. My Australian family thinks it's hilarious that Eastbourne is called the Sunshine Coast. they call it the Unshine Coast, which is very unkind, and I shouldn't really repeat that line. But anyway, I live there with my wife Emma, my daughter Ruby, our son JJ. And my day job is as an evangelist, to go around and shoot my mouth off about Jesus.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been an evangelist since 2010. Well, at least on my business card, the word evangelist has appeared since 2010. I've been working for this charity, which is now called Speak Life, since 2010. And before that, I was I'm ordained in the Anglican Church, so I was a curate, which is a kind of a vicar with your L plates on, and I did that in Eastbourne. And at the end of that, I continued to go to our church, All Souls Eastbourne, but my day job is to go around and to speak in schools and churches and universities and to introduce people to Jesus.
Because that's your day job, we thought that we'd talk to you first of all about evangelism. And you said that you go around other churches and I think universities and other sort of things. What do you think is the kind of spiritual climate, if I could put it like that, in the UK? Is it hard to be an evangelist at the moment? Is it really easy? Is there a lot of opportunities? How does it feel kind of in the world? And then I'll ask you how it feels in the church as well. But how does it feel kind of just generally going around? What's it like?
I think it's harder because the culture is fracturing, but it's also more fruitful because the culture is fracturing. So there are a lot more voices out there, and a lot of those voices are more angry and more hardened. But also there's the understanding that different people do have different views, and people are beginning to explore alternatives, and Christianity is one of those alternatives that people are kind of looking at. So, you know, you go to the sort of social attitude surveys and we'll see that, you know, something like more than half the UK population describes themselves as none, N-O-N-E. When they're asked what is their spiritual view, do they have a religion, they say no, none. And, you know, those who check the box that say Christian are about a third of the population. But, you know, that third who do say that they're a Christian, it's starting to mean more and more. And so one of my lines is, I kind of say, when I go around and talk about Christianity, if you're over 65 and you tell me that you're a Christian, I don't believe you. Largely because, you know, 65 years ago, it was very easy to put the Christian label on, and that helps you to navigate the world frictionlessly. And so there's such a thing as nominal Christianity. And we've always known that there's such a thing as nominal Christianity. But as the culture is fracturing more and more, then those who own the label Christian do so because they've thought about it a little bit more than in previous years. So if you're over 65 and you tell me you're a Christian, I don't believe you. But I've got a similar rule of thumb. If you're under 35 and you say you're an atheist, I don't believe you. And for exactly the same reasons, because it's very easy these days to stick the atheist label on, and that helps you to navigate life frictionlessly. And it doesn't mean, if somebody says they're an atheist these days, that they've done more than 3 minutes of metaphysical thought. They are not hardened atheists. You're not dealing with Richard Dawkins just because somebody tells you that they're an atheist. Of course they're an atheist, because there's something called nominal atheism. There are such things as nominal nuns, or nomi-nuns. I don't think that term is going to catch on, but I'm trying to get it
out. I quite like
it. Nomi-nuns. Yeah, nominal nuns.
I don't think it works.
It doesn't mean that these guys have thought very deeply about ontological naturalism or anything else, you know, philosophically. It just means it's much easier these days to just say I'm an agnostic or an atheist. And
when you said nominal nuns, by the way, I got a bit confused, because I was thinking of nuns in habits, and I was just about to make a joke about, you know, habits, things catching on and everything else to do with nuns, and it took me the last few seconds to work out it was N-O-N-E-S.
N-O-N-E-S, yeah. So on the census form, when you are asked what is your, you know, religious spiritual belief, more and more, in fact, now over half of people tick the box that says none. I have no religion. There isn't, you know, when I'm asked what my religion is, I have none. So that's that's the spiritual state of play. But when you press into those people who say that they're a nun, N-O-N-E, or whether they say they're an atheist or an agnostic, quite often my next question is, and what are you praying for at the moment? And they'll say, you know, actually my mum's gone into hospital, etc., you know. And it's not that they are, you know, committed to this philosophical atheism. It's simply that they probably don't buy into institutional religion. And fewer people are, you know, buying into any kind of institutional forms of life or culture at all. So people joining sports clubs is way down on what it was even, you know, 10, 20 years ago. People joining all sorts of clubs, people signing up to all sorts of membership associations is going way down. We are fracturing down to, you know, a single unit of people just staring at our iPhones. The fact that numbers who, you know, are claiming allegiance to institutional religion, the fact that those numbers are going down, is not just a spiritual barometer. It's also a social and cultural barometer. But as people are fracturing in these ways, there are so many more opportunities to go beyond the labels and to just get curious. So I always say, you know, when people say they're an atheist, that is not the end of the conversation. You know, quite often I'll just say to people, you know, so which God don't you believe in? And they might look at me a little bit strange to begin with, but then they'll end up describing to me the God they don't believe in. And it ends up being some distant individual, high on power, low on personality, with a thunderbolt ready to hurl. And I just, you know, end up saying, that sounds like Zeus. I don't really believe in Zeus either. Can we talk about Jesus? And I think increasingly, as the culture fractures, we're able to get beyond the labels and start talking about Jesus. So that's a win.
Do you think people do want to chat about spirituality, or are they just kind of not really engaging at all, quite happy to be with the kind of the nun label, as it were? Or are you finding the opposite?
Yeah, I mean, two things are going on at the same time. I think we are more comfortable than we have ever been, and we're becoming more dissatisfied than we've ever been. And both those things are working against each other. But we certainly are, just economically, financially, socially, culturally, health-wise, we are more comfortable than any human beings who have ever walked the planet. And so that always works against the gospel, because, you know, Jesus said it's either God or mammon. And we've got a heck of a lot of mammon, let's be honest.
Yep.
So that's working against the gospel going out. But what's working for it is that as people are more financially secure, they are realizing that it really does not satisfy. And people are, you know, it's the old G.K. Chesterton line, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they start believing in anything. And people are becoming incredibly hungry and going to all sorts of strange and weird and wonderful beliefs in order to find that meaning. So on that hand, there are opportunities.
If you were to take a sort of view of the church, would you say, in your observation, it's dying or it's thriving? Because if you look at the social attitude survey that you mentioned, the number of atheists has topped kind of half, and Christians a bit under that. people who believe in God or a higher power are more than half of us. But kind of Christianity, certainly institutional Christianity, is massively on the decline.
I do think that the elimination of the mushy middle is something that we're all having to deal with. So the mushy middle is in between, you know, you can imagine a spectrum of people lining up, and on the left of the spectrum, you've got people who are really very keen about Jesus. And on the right, you've got, you know, people who are really not keen about Jesus at all. In the middle, you've got a third of the population that could lean one way or could lean the other way, depending on, you know, the cultural winds that are blowing. Right now, that mushy middle is blowing towards the right. And I do think that is leaving the church more and more exposed, but more and more certain that those who stick with Jesus really do want Jesus. And I've just spent, you know, the last sort of 5 weeks, I've done four different mission weeks with various churches around the country, and I've seen dozens of people trusting in Jesus in the last, you know, 5 weeks. So people are coming to Christ for the first time. Even just yesterday, I was preaching in a church here in Eastbourne, and there was a guy who he must have been in his late 70s, if not early 80s, and had, you know, told me he'd been resisting Christ his whole life, and he put his hand into Jesus' hands just this morning. He told me, and you know that is happening all over the country at the same time as. Nominals are leaving the church. Those who really see and know and love Jesus are joining. And I guess we've got to believe that when Jesus says, if you abide in me, you will produce much fruit. We've got to believe that he is telling the truth. Interestingly, in that John 15, at the same time, there are branches that are being snapped off. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing nominal branches snapped off, but we are seeing the buds of new life.
Do you think, Glenn, just wondering on that, because often we're told, you know, that there isn't that much fruit through the church at the moment. It's very small numbers. Are those that you're seeing converted, are they, I mean, the other truth we're told is that it takes 10, 15 years for someone to become a believer. I mean, are you seeing that those who are coming to faith are just those who have been in church for years, you know, decade? Or are these people who have come being befriended and being brought in and to these mission weeks and coming to faith on that basis? I mean, what's your feel on that?
Yeah, I think the common denominator in, certainly if I think back to the mission that has gone the best in the last month, I think of a church that has served its community really, really well. They've had a kind of a church-run nursery that is incredibly well thought of in the area, and you know, so many people from that part of the world have been through this particular nursery and the childcare, and they've got to know the church in lots of different ways there, and they run cap money courses and things like that. So they are very well thought of in the area, and they are at the heart of. You know, their locality. So that's one thing that stands out about that church that's done very well. The other thing that really stands out about that church is extraordinary prayer. So they were putting on, you know, all nights of prayer and half nights of prayer in the run-up to this mission week. And I do think if we want to see something extraordinary, and what could be more extraordinary than someone turning from idols to serve the living God? What could be more, you know, extraordinary than coming from death to life? If we want extraordinary things, I do think we need to do extraordinary things. And I think extraordinary prayer ought to be at the heart of our mission strategy. And that was certainly true for this church. And actually, in all the events that we did, we did a thing where I kind of interviewed an interesting person and then preached off the back of it. And at every single one of these six events, there were people saying at the end that they prayed to receive Christ. Sometimes, you know, four or five saying that at these events. So those would be two things I would say, that in the places where I see fruit, there is a real love for the locality and love for the community, and there is extraordinary prayer going on.
Yes,
that's really helpful. Just to reinforce really what you were saying just a moment ago, I think our experience in a small way locally is that the older generation are actually much harder to witness to evangelize than the younger generation in a way. If you can at least get them into a meeting, actually, the younger generation are much more receptive. So just recently, a Christianity Explored, or one of those courses that I was running, the older person, the person over 70, was the one who wanted to argue about evolution and had lots of opinions about God.
Right.
The younger people in that group, actually, I think the two who were in that group, they both became Christians. They had hardly any prior knowledge. They had a bit of Catholic background. Hardly any prior knowledge, very little prejudice in a way. Didn't want to talk about evolution at all. They wanted to talk about ethics, about whether God is good, much more than evolution point. So, yeah, that's certainly our experience.
That morality point is really important, I think, in evangelism today. I think that... And speaking to other evangelists, they tend to say that is the way that really is a fruitful way into conversation, because we tend to take for granted, for instance, that, you know, human equality, we're all equal, even though people have like wildly different strengths and abilities and economic value. We have this weird religious belief that all people are equal. And of course, we've got it from the Bible. And of course, you can't ground that belief anywhere else. Using that intuition and that moral argument for God's existence is proving increasingly fruitful, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting as well. What do you think? I mean, you mentioned a little bit in saying what churches should be doing, but do you feel like the churches that you're connected with at least are complacent about evangelism, kind of enthusiastic about it? Where do you think we as churches might be going wrong, might need to really think carefully about what we're doing a bit more?
I guess by the nature of the case, I'm dealing with the churches that most want to do evangelism because they get in contact with me, because, you know, they want to take things a little bit further. And so that's always encouraging. Overwhelmingly, you've got to assume that complacency is the default, because, you know, we are fleshly, sluggish creatures, and we never want to go beyond our comfort zones. And that's you know, my biggest struggle, really. My biggest struggle is to really believe that if I go out from myself into a place of vulnerability, then I think that would be death. And actually, Jesus kind of says, no, that is a kind of death, but it's the cross-like death that leads to a resurrection and new life. But always my belief is I want to go for comfort. I want to go for ease. I don't want to cause a stir. I don't want people to sneer at me. I don't want people to think I'm stupid or bigoted or unkind or benighted. I don't want people to think anything like that of me. And so, yeah, and you multiply that in the Christian population at large, and what do you get? You get, you know, sluggish churches that don't particularly want to reach out. And again, what I try to do is, I try to remind people of the goodness of the good news, because so often I'll do some evangelism training and someone will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, oh, Glenn, you know, thank you for sharing that. Of course, I have no gift with words. That, you know, they say, Glenn, you seem to have a little gift with words. I don't have, you know, I don't have any facility with words, which always comes as a shock, because I've usually had a conversation with them for about 5 or 10 minutes and they've talked to me perfectly fine about the cricket and the football and the weather. But they've got no power with words. And you think, well, no, actually, we all talk about what is most dear to our hearts. It's so interesting in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, the great verse on personal evangelism. It begins with, set apart Christ as Lord in your heart, and then you're prepared to give an answer to those who ask you for the hope that is within you. So setting apart Christ in our Lord as in our hearts as Lord is absolutely vital, I think. You know, Jesus said, Matthew 12, verse 34, from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so really, number one, what we really need to be doing is going back to the goodness of Jesus and seeing how amazing he is, because if our hearts are full of him, then our words will follow, however feebly or falteringly they come out. The words will follow. So that's number one, is really getting people back to the goodness of the good news and the glory of Jesus. But then number two, I do think we need to have a kind of a cross and resurrection shaped spirituality, where we truly believe that if I expose myself to the world in an offer of grace, yes, it will feel excruciating. That's what it felt like for Jesus. But also, that is where the life is, and that is where the resurrection is. That is where fruit really comes. And so I take people to kind of Hebrews 13, where, you know, the author to the Hebrews says, Christ was sacrificed outside the city gate. Let us therefore go to him outside the gate. And I just think that's really interesting, because the place that is outside the city gates is the place that is beyond the four walls of the community of God's people. It's a dangerous place. It's an unclean place. And yet that's where Jesus is found. And so one of my encouragements to churches is really that as you do make yourself vulnerable, as you go beyond the four walls of the Christian community, as you go into the unsafe place, as you go to the unclean place, there you find Jesus. And, you know, it's been my experience throughout my life that the closest times of fellowship with Jesus have been when I'm on the front lines of mission, actually, and exposing myself to a world that largely doesn't want to hear. And yet the presence and the fellowship of Jesus in those moments is really, really precious. So, you know, it can sound even like a selfish thing. Like, if you want your spiritual life to really go well, then why don't you get involved in mission? And churches, if we want our churches to really flourish and thrive, let's be opening up our communities, going to the dangerous place, going to the unsafe place, and there we'll find Jesus in a way that we've never experienced before.
What do you think about yourself? What do you think about your role? I mean, you may have all sorts of thoughts about yourself, but you're an evangelist. I guess you really want churches to kind of put you out of a job in that they're all doing it and it's all kind of happening. And is your role, you think it's a biblical one? Do you think it's a kind of a statement of failure in the end that churches are having to call in an expert? How does that kind of work in your head?
Yeah, well, I hope that churches give me a job rather than put me out of a job in that. You know, I go to Ephesians 4 and I look at, you know, how the ascended Christ has given gifts to his church, and the gifts that he's given to his church are people, and in particular they are word ministers, actually, when you think of the apostles and the prophets and the pastor teachers and the evangelists, to build up God's people for their works of service. So evangelists are to come from the church, they are for the church, and that's really interesting, isn't it? It's not as though the ascended Christ gives evangelists to forget the church and bypass the church and go straight to the ungodly and preach the gospel to them. It's not that at all. It's that evangelists, our first audience is the church, and our first duty is to equip the saints for their works of evangelistic service. So I completely see that there are far too many evangelists who bypass the church, who thinks the church is moribund and dead, and that's why God needs me, right? I have met such people. I've met such very proud evangelists who have no place for the local church in their own spiritual life, who have no place for the local church in their own concept of mission. They think they're an evangelist because the church is dead and they've got to go and do something themselves. And that couldn't be further from the truth. A couple of years ago, an evangelist said to me, he thought that the church was going to miss the next big move of God. And so he wanted everybody to give him money so that he could come and be an evangelist, because the church is so moribund, it's so asleep, it's going to miss the next big move of God. And I just said to him, that's impossible. The church is the move of God. Like, the church is what God is doing in the world. The church is God's mission strategy for the world. So what then is the place for the evangelist? The place for the evangelist is to equip God's people for their works of service. And part of how I do that is, you know, when I'm face-to-face with people, so some of my ministry is kind of producing resources and videos and that sort of thing. But if you set that part of my ministry aside, I split things 50-50. Part of it is me training Christians in evangelism, training Christians in ordinary, everyday witness. And then part of my time that I spend is kind of, in a sense, showing how it's done. And even as I'm doing that, even as I'm going on these mission trips and preaching to unbelievers, a big part of my ministry there is saying to Christians, do you see what I did there? Do you see how I answered that question? Maybe that's something that you could do in your mission. And I find that that's definitely a ministry of the evangelist, is even as you're facing the non-Christian, you are equipping the saints for their works of witnessing to their non-Christian friends. So I completely agree that very often evangelists get this wrong and they become these you know, crazed lone rangers. But when we turn to Ephesians 4, I think we see that actually it's church and the evangelist working together.
I think it sounds like we need a whole other podcast episode just talking through how you would equip the church. Because from what you said, you would do a mission, presumably you'd do a little bit of a training before that mission, and then, you know, kind of give us a bit of a flavour of how you begin to equip a church and prepare them for mission and help them. Obviously, there's the put before them the good news of Jesus, remind them of going outside the walls, but how do we actually begin to really push people and help them in that? Because although I imagine most believers know that, but struggle with that. What kind of practical things could we, you know, in terms of helping people equip and getting out there and taking that first step, as it were?
Yeah, and we all struggle with this. I struggle with this because the struggle that I feel with evangelism, first thing I want to say is it's not just particular to evangelism. It's just the struggle that I have with my flesh. It's just the struggle that I have because I'm a selfish so-and-so and I want to serve me. That's my biggest problem in evangelism. And therefore, my biggest need is not so much to be given tips and techniques and how to polish up my, you know, my words and how to have a, you know, a sentence that can change the conversation from one direction to another direction. And it's not about tips and techniques about that first and foremost. It is about my heart. It is about the glory of Jesus filling my heart that it might overflow. But then there are things that you can do to help people, just to share in everyday life. So sometimes I train people in four little questions, or really sentences up their sleeve that they can use. I never give them the full sentence. They've got to finish the sentence for themselves. But things like, what gets you up in the morning? I'll go through all four and then I'll talk about what I say. What gets you up? What gets you down? What gets you thinking and what gets you through? What gets you up? What gets you down? What gets you thinking? What gets you through? And you know, what gets you up is you want to have a good conversation. People always want to ask me how do I have a God conversation? And you know, step one is, well, try to have a good conversation first. And then if you're talking about things that really matter, then hopefully you're a hop, skip, and a jump from some kind of gospel content that you can bring. So, you know, what gets you up in the morning? Get people talking about what really makes them tick. And then have in the back of your head, what is it that gets you up in the morning? And hopefully what gets you up in the morning is that you have a God of love who's loved you to hell and back, who has a glorious future for the world that is beyond anything that this world has ever imagined. Hopefully there's some kind of way that you can answer that question, and you need to figure out how you answer that question. But ask people what gets you up, ask people what gets you down. So often in evangelism, you think that you've got to talk about rainbows and puppies and kittens and sunshine and flowers and everything's lovely and isn't Jesus great? Whereas actually the best evangelism that you can do happens when you talk about what really slays you, what really makes you despair. And often I find that, you know, it's Christians who are more realistic than that than non-Christians, because they've got to make this world work for them. And so they're not going to face what gets them down in a genuine way. But we need to start talking about what really gets us down.
Glenn, that is absolutely brilliant. And we want to know how you deal with the next two questions. We're almost run out of time for this episode.
Okay.
So we're going to actually invite you back for another podcast.
Okay.
To carry on talking about this, talk about your third and fourth questions, and a little bit more about, I want to talk about big events compared to small events.
Okay.
So we're going to pause for just a moment, and then we're going to have you back for the next episode.
Let's do it.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ordinary. Of course, a special thank you to Glenn for joining us. And if you want to hear more from Glenn, then a great place to start would be speaklife.org.uk. You'll find lots of resources and information about Glenn's ministry there. Join us again next time for part two of this conversation with Glenn Scrivener.